Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL podcast. I'm Connor Rohr. We've got Albert Breer here, and this was the week where the undefeateds fell. We're going to start right there. We're just going to get into it because, you know, no one wants to hear me talk about my weekend, even though I didn't do any pumpkin picking or anything. Albert, are you doing any big fall festival things, is this too early right now?
I do zero pumpkin picking. We did go
Wait, you don't pumpkin pick at all?
No, we did.
What?
Emily's super into Halloween. So our oldest was born on Halloween, and Emily's super into it. So she decorates the house a lot. You'll find this as your kids get older, though. Like, we used to do like the pumpkin picking, the apple picking, you know, going to whatever on a Saturday afternoon, and then they got older, and now it's like we have football and soccer and dance and all this different stuff. So, that's one thing I have found is like a lot of those things we did when the kids were, I would say, younger than five, sort of start to get thrown out the window once their schedules fill up with their own things.
Man, I feel so like you've got to make
that's what you have had for you.
You always got to make time for apple cider donuts. I feel like that's like.
Oh no, you can buy those. You don't need to. There doesn't need to be any elaborate trip to go and do that.
That's fair. We decorated. So my kids kind of got wind of Halloween as a thing, probably around like mid September, very early September, and they found the decorations in the basement, and they were like, "What's the difference? Why don't we just throw it out there now?" And so my wife and I, like lunatics, were putting tombstones.
So you're like the people who put Christmas stuff out before Thanksgiving now, except for Halloween.
Oh yeah, but that's the problem, right? So I am always November 1 Christmas lights, always.
Oh, so always you are a pre-Thanksgiving Christmas decoration.
200%, and I get so much shit for it. But my thing is, it is such an undertaking. It is such an undertaking. You know, you have to be on the roof.
So you're like legitimately Clark Griswold then.
I am. I have the icicle lights. I wrap all the railings. I wrap all the trees. And then I have every year for Christmas, I get more, but they're like the 3-foot inflatable animals with like scarves and hats. And I think I'm up to like 9 or 10 of those. And so my thing is, why would you want to be freezing your ass off on a ladder on like November 30th when you could do it November 1? It's crisp. It's a beautiful fall day. And then you're lighting up the neighborhood for everybody else. You know, I don't know. I take pride in that. But now we're early Halloween and early Christmas. And I think
that like covers like the first half of the school year almost then.
Yeah.
Because that's pretty crazy. Like that's. Yeah, so we had like I said, my wife's really into Halloween, and last week we bought a so there's like this street. You guys, I'm sure you've seen this, but like one thing, like I feel like you always see this. Like every town has these streets, right? Like where like everybody on the street goes nuts for Christmas, or everyone on the street goes nuts for Halloween, right? Like
right.
And so like there's this like little like I don't even know if I'd call it a street, but there's like four houses on it. It's like a long driveway, right? And I guess for decades, they've done this just such an elaborate Halloween display on Halloween, like on Halloween itself. It is like unbelievable, right? Like just like looks like you're in a movie set when you walk through it. And, you know, there's this older couple that ran the whole thing for years and years. And so this was the year they decided, like, our kids are older. We can't do it anymore. We're not going to do it. So they sold all their stuff. And it was a yard sale, basically. They called it the ghoul sale, right? Was basically at the end of our driveway, which meant last week when I got home from the hotel after staying up all night writing and everything, I was helping the older guy who owned all this stuff walk a 12-foot skeleton, which weighed like legitimately 90 or 100 pounds, down his driveway and up my driveway. And now, and I will send you a picture, Connor, to prove this, and you can tweet it out with the podcast link. We now have a 12-foot skeleton at the as you turn down our driveway, you can see our house.
It's created a weird thing where my wife and I went to Home Depot or Lowe's the other day to pick out cabinet fixtures, which was, you know, really solid day. And it is, the entire store now is, they've got Christmas out now for people like me who do their decorations November 1, but all right. the Halloween decorations are out for the people like everybody else who didn't even think about decorating for the Halloween until this week. Yeah, normal people. And so every home improvement store now is just a vomit of Santa Clauses, fake snow, but then fake spider webs and massive spiders. And it's like this weird sort of like my brain can't wrap its head around it. And I think we have to set hard limits. I know I'm part of the problem, but it's like McDonald's breakfast, right? McDonald's defined when breakfast started and ended. And then they went haywire. Now you can get an Egg McMuffin whenever you want, which
because it was 10:30, right?
I think it was 10:30
or 11.
Yeah. Oh, no, it was 11. You're right. It was 11.
Yeah.
And I feel like we need to bring that back. We need to bring back some limitations, but I'm part of the problem. Anyway, Albert, the 49ers lost a football game, and we'll start there. They're no longer undefeated. And I went back and I watched it this morning, and my initial thoughts here were great win for Cleveland. I don't think anybody has added more value, singular person, to a team in an offseason more than Jim Schwartz has the Browns. That said, I counted three missed touchdowns by San Francisco that they probably have on another day. There was a missed field goal to end it. There was Christian McCaffrey getting injured. All that said, nice win for Cleveland. I feel like this is one of those that, and I wrote this, okay, half of what I wrote is sort of a jab still at signing Deshaun Watson, but I do think this is a win that legitimizes the right part of their build, right? They had years, they had tons of draft equity, they had a lot of chances to try and fail, but they did build a defensive football team capable of surviving in the AFC North with the Ravens and the Steelers. That is not an easy thing to do, and they've done that.
And they hit on high draft picks, like you said. Like they hit on Myles Garrett. They hit on Denzel Ward. They've got depth in the secondary now, and Greg Newsome and Emerson playing alongside Ward. And you just kind of look at them across the board. Even some free agent signings like Za'Darius Smith, who seems to wear out his welcome after a year or two everywhere, but is like a good short term signing. They built a defense that's athletic at every level, and they've, found a defensive coordinator to unlock all of that, who's got that group playing so fast. And that's what I hear from everybody, who's there about what Schwartz has done, is he's got them playing fast, which I think has unlocked the potential that those guys have as athletes with all the high draft picks that are there. And then I just think, I think it's like an offense now that understands what it has to do to win a game. I know that sounds weird, but with no Deshaun Watson and no Nick Chubb, it's sort of like, and you watch how PJ Walker managed that game and some of the plays that he made down the stretch. It's an offense that knows what it is, that like knows it can't play outside of the lines or it's going to take away from the strength of the team. And so what I think will be interesting, Connor, is if they can get Deshaun to play the way that he did against Tennessee consistently. Because he played really well in that Tennessee game, got hurt, went out. And, I think they'd finally started to figure out where they wanted that offense to be, what they wanted the offense to look like with Deshaun Watson as the quarterback. And it's been a year and a half process for them to get there. So when he comes back, if he can hit the ground running the way that he was playing against Tennessee, I don't know. I mean, the Bengals have – I think the Bengals are turning the corner now, but they're still 3-3. The Ravens are 4-2. Are they world beaters? I don't know. I mean, it feels like it might actually be a more winnable division than we would have thought 6 weeks ago.
I agree with you. My question is, and I wrote this in the column yesterday. I said, is it too soon to ask this? A lot of Browns fans in the mentions, yes, they say too soon to ask this. But what if Deshaun never becomes Deshaun in Houston, right? And I know that's a big what if, and I know he had a year off of football, and I know we're 9 games in. But, I went through his 9 games yesterday, and I think it was like four or five of the 9 games, his quarterback rating was within 20 to 25 points of what PJ Walker's was yesterday, which is about like a 45.5, right? Yeah. And, granted, Baker Mayfield, Josh Dobbs, a lot of these guys are going to turn into pumpkins at some point later in the year. But, you know, you did all the hard work, right? And like you're saying, did you need to do this ultimately? Like, did you need to do this? That to me is like the million-dollar question, because what if you had Derek Carr? What if you had Jimmy Garoppolo? What if you had Ryan Tannehill? What if you had like any of these guys that would play on schedule within the offense and didn't cost $250 million guaranteed, didn't have to cost all the draft equity, and doesn't cost you the massive public relations issue? Like,
I think
they'd probably be – they'd still be good.
I think the way that – so like just to kind of give you an idea of like the way I think that they saw it was – they were sort of looking up Mount Mahomes, so to speak. And I think they were saying to themselves, can we build a team that can win 11 games? Sure we can. Is that team ever going to be good enough to beat Joe Burrow, Josh Allen, and Patrick Mahomes in succession without having a quarterback who can at least put us on a level with that guy? And the answer they came to was no. You know, like, and that was, I think that's sort of what it was, is like, what you're talking about is winning a Super Bowl with Joe Flacco, winning a Super Bowl with Eli Manning, winning a Super Bowl with the second year Russell Wilson. And we all made a lot of those quarterbacks at those times, right? Which, great, you won a Super Bowl. You should, those guys should get a ton of credit. But those teams weren't about those guys. That Giants team was about the defensive line, right? Both the Giants teams that won with Eli were about the defensive line. The Joe Flacco Ravens and the Russell Wilson Seahawks, those were about running game and defense. Like, and I think the broader question here is, can you win that way anymore? Essentially, can you win with the 10th best quarterback in the league? And I think the Browns' conclusion in trading for Deshaun Watson was that you can't. Was that you cannot win the whole thing with the 10th best quarterback in the league or the 12th best quarterback in the league, especially in the AFC, where it's not just beating one, it's beating three guys who might be at that level. And that's what I think is really interesting about the bet that the Browns made on Deshaun Watson. It wasn't just Deshaun Watson can get us into that club, like can get us inside the velvet rope. You know what I mean? Like where the Chiefs are, where the Bills are, where the Bengals are, where the Chargers are. It's also that if you aren't inside that velvet rope, you have no chance at all.
I think that there's something to be said about, you know, because I've made this argument with the Patriots where I think that they're version of roster building has passed them by. We talked about this last week. This is a talent hoarding league. But, you know, like you said, it's interesting, right? Deshaun Watson is right now, depending on how you look at it, probably the 22nd or 23rd best quarterback in the league. It would take a pretty strong effort to wind up as like the 11th or 12th best quarterback in the league here. And so it's, to me, I'm just looking at it as, you know, and listen, there are Browns fans all over the map on this. I'm not telling anyone what to think or what to do, but wouldn't this team have been a blast if they just, like, I don't know, held on to Baker? Or like, and I understand, like, okay, Baker is like a very polarizing word, but like Josh Dobbs, like, you know,
or, well, especially,
you know,
so, if you could keep Baker at like $10 million, like, you know what I mean? Like, if you like, because that's the problem with it, you know, is like, that wasn't the context under which they would have been able to keep Baker. They would have been able to keep Baker under the context of he's getting a huge second contract.
He's getting a Daniel Jones kind of contract.
Right. Like, so you can say that now because you look at Baker and Tampa and it's like, oh my God, like that looks pretty good. And they're paying almost nothing for him. But the Browns didn't have the option to pay almost nothing for him. You know, like the Giants, like no one else was paying Daniel Jones $40 million. Why the Giants? Because they sort of had to. Like, when you take a guy that high, that's the price of the second contract. And I know logically it's like easy to say, well, why don't you just refuse to do it? Well, it's really hard to let a guy like that just go to the market and risk not having a quarterback at all. Yeah. So, you know, it's a complicated thing with quarterbacks. And I think it was the way the Browns saw it was a chance to level up. And it's not that they didn't like Baker, because if they didn't like Baker, they wouldn't have picked up that fifth-year option in the first place. It was more like, we need to get inside of this. And you know, I think what's interesting about it too, Connor, is that maybe it's a little conference-specific too.
Sure.
You know? Like, because if you're in the NFC,
do you do that? Yeah.
Right. Because if you're an NFC team, like last year, the NFC championship game was Jalen Hurts. All due respect, he's a really good quarterback, but is he Burrow or Mahomes or Allen, I don't probably level down from that, right?
Sure.
Like where, you know, it's Hurts versus Purdy in the NFC Championship game. Well, if you're an NFC team, you might look at it and say, like, all we got to do is we can get to the Super Bowl with this quarterback, and then it's just one game. It's different if you're in the AFC, where you might have to beat three of those guys consecutively.
Only note I have from this game that we kind of didn't get to. I mean, obviously the McCaffrey injury.
I'm assuming we're taking this as like health permitting a hiccup for the Niners, right?
Yes, 100%. Yeah. But outside of that, Amari Cooper played out of his mind in this game. That might have been the best game that I've seen him play as a Brown.
Yeah.
And I think what you're seeing is, again, I'll put a bookmark on it by saying if Deshaun Watson plays the way that he did against Tennessee at a consistent basis for a long period of time, I think that this team could make it to the conference title game. That wouldn't surprise me. The defense is that good. What surprises me, and this is the only other what-if scenario.
So, you know what would be fun? If you were the Browns, would you trade for Derrick Henry?
Oh, my God.
I mean, say Deshaun plays really well on Sunday, right? He comes back, plays great. Would you, like, throw the Titans a second-round pick for – or second- or third-round pick for Derrick Henry?
Yes. Is Derrick Henry on the block?
I don't know if he's on the block, but if you're like the new general manager in Tennessee, you're Rand Carthon. I mean, do you think about it? If somebody offers you a two, right? And he's in a contract year anyway, and you have to calculate what you're willing to pay him. And remember, it's always a little more expensive to keep your own players than if they go elsewhere, right? Like, would Derrick Henry be willing to accept less to stay in Tennessee? I don't know. I mean, I think it's something to consider, especially if Tennessee potentially could take a quarterback this year, you know? So I think, like, it would be interesting if the Browns got a really good game or two out of Deshaun before the trade deadline here. Their bye isn't coming up. They already had their bye. So mm-hmm. If they got a really good game or two out of Deshaun Watson and maybe got that feeling, oh, wait a minute, we're kind of close now. If you're them, do you trade for a bell cow back to sort of take the place of Nick Chubb, be that placeholder for you so you can go chase something in November and December and January? It's a fun idea, right?
It's a fun idea, but then it goes back around to my...
But that would go like so against the way that they've run their organization too, so I don't know.
And then it just goes back to my point that it's like, if you're doing all this, what was the point of getting Deshaun Watson in the first place? But again, anyway, I understand the move from a calculated on-field perspective. It's just interesting to me that this sort of your signature win of the Di Podesta, Andrew Berry, you know, that thought group comes without your quarterback on the field, which is just kind of funny. But let's move on to the other undefeated falling, the New York Jets beating the Philadelphia Eagles at home. I'm just saying this right now. If I'm Woody Johnson, the first thing I do this morning when I wake up in the Maldives on my yacht, because that's what you do after a game, right? You have like a 4 o'clock game as an owner. You can sleep in like...
In flight.
You know, yeah, you can sleep in flight. You can be in the... What is it, the Mediterranean? You can be sailing.
I do is like get myself a nice cup of coffee and go sit on the deck of the yacht. You know, like
of the yacht.
I think that'd be the first thing I'd do, maybe before whatever you're saying you're going to do is here.
It's possible if you're a billionaire to wake up in the Mediterranean every morning and have your coffee, and then just be back in Teterboro, you know, and just show up at the Jets facility at like 1 or 2. But so when I do that, if I'm Woody Johnson, I'm walking through the door at like 2 o'clock, I'm tanned, I'm rested, I've had my breakfast in Greece, I feel great. I'd extend Robert Saleh's contract. Like,
wow.
I just think, okay. And
that team is so much fun to watch.
There's, but
oh my God, that team is so much fun to watch.
here's what drives me nuts. Like, you know, and I say this all the time. I live in New York. I listen to The Fan every day. I think it's awesome. I think the fans are awesome. I've covered the Jets and the Giants. I know these people. But, like, how do you not realize where you were as a franchise 3 years ago? You are in games against the Eagles with Zach Wilson as your quarterback.
Against the Chiefs.
You were one Taylor Swift conspiracy theory call away from beating the Kansas City Chiefs on Sunday Night Football. Like, 3 years ago, you were zero blitzing a Hail Mary against the Raiders at the end of a game. You were paying Le'Veon Bell. Like, this team was terrible. And now there's, like they did the hard work. They earned it. Give them the money.
This is beautiful. Like, I feel like their games are so beautifully chaotic. You know what I mean? Like, and it's such proof to me that, like, in this sport, it doesn't need to be 450 yards passing for it to be entertaining.
No.
Like, they are such an entertaining team to watch, and they can win 3-0, and it can be so entertaining because they create chaos on defense. They're hard to play against. Their offense has playmakers. They're scattershot, but their offense does have some playmakers in Garrett Wilson and Breece Hall. And, yeah, man, I talked to C.J. Mosley after the game, and you know, I asked him about, like, how, you know, he's sort of in an interesting spot because, like, his last two football stops were Alabama and the Ravens, right? And so he was part of maintaining a tradition in those places, you know, like maintaining something on defense. And now he's been part of building something with the Jets. And, you know, he was saying, like, how high a standard they hold for each other and how high the bar is now for the defense. And it's such an interesting thing because of where they were when Saleh got there. And so I think what you're saying is, like, the ability to set a high standard the way he has and have a locker room that's sort of taken ownership of that, and now they're setting a high standard, and that standard is, like, impervious to a quarterback injury, you know, where a lot of times when a team loses its quarterback, especially when so much is built around that quarterback the way that it was with the Jets – with Aaron Rodgers, like, the strength of that operation to be able to withstand that, and there's no, like, mourning period, or there's no, like, oh, like, that guy over in the corner of the locker room.
It's not even a mourning quarter. You went out and you beat the Bills. Like, right? It's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, and it's just, like, you can – I always feel like the teams – like, you can see when a coach has really rubbed off on his teams. Like, the best Belichick teams – played so smart, right? The best Andy Reid teams, they look really creative. Even the players, the way they play looks creative, right? You can see Saleh's energy rubbing off on that entire team, the way they play, you know? And so there's talent on the roster. Joe Douglas has done a nice job of making that a very, very athletic roster across the board. They've got superstar, like, cornerstone players. And again, your Wilsons, your Halls, your Quinnen Williams, your C.J. Mosleys, your Sauce Gardeners, almost all of them. Mosley, obviously not, but almost all of them are homegrown. And, yeah, I don't know if I'd extend him right now, but I would think about it because it's clear that that team buys into what Robert Saleh is selling it.
To me, and again, I understand people who don't see it this way, but, and I'm just throwing this out as an example, but, like, if you were to somehow extract coaching effort and ability and all that kind of stuff into a number, like a wins above replacement number, you know, what would Robert Saleh be compared to, you know, like we talk about Bill Belichick being a great coach, Sean Payton being a great coach, Andy Reid being a great coach. How much harder has Robert Saleh had to work than all of these other people, maybe combined, to get this to a point where, did you see Zach Wilson yesterday on the 2-point conversion? Cool as a cucumber. Like, when he hits Randall Cobb for that go-ahead, Zach Wilson is now using his mobility to pick up first downs. There is a competence in his game that we've never seen before. Like, all of this stuff is happening live. Like, they're just doing it. And I'm so amazed at how high the talent has come to where it was at the beginning and 2 years ago. I mean, you know, you and I go to these training camp stops. We go to these things. I remember Zach Wilson's first few practices. It was awful. And to see how far it's come is, and maybe I'm too like close because it is the closest team. I see it up close more often, yeah. But it's just like, man, I mean, to me, that this is the best coaching job in the NFL, and I don't think it's even close.
Right. So they're 3-3 now, which is pretty amazing considering.
Toughest like, part of your schedule is kind of behind you too.
Right, right. And so like, and they have that carrot out there too that Aaron Rodgers somehow wasn't on crutches. What is it, 6 weeks after an Achilles?
Throwing the ball around.
I mean, I don't know what he's taking out there in California. Maybe we could all use some of it, but
I know.
Like if he gets back, like, I mean, if you have that out there for you, and the potential of Aaron Rodgers walking back in the middle of January. And, I mean, it's going to be tough to make the playoffs in the AFC. But I'll tell you what, like, they beat the Bills. They look like they've got the speed. They're one of the few teams that has the speed to run with the Dolphins. And they're flat out better than the Patriots. Right, I don't care what happened a couple weeks ago. They are flat out better than the Patriots. Like you could see how that team could sneak in as a 7 seed, and if they do, you know, maybe there's a guy wearing number 8 on the other end of that for them.
Oof. My only other thoughts from this Jets game, Albert, are you know you look at you know and. I'll put this to the side. The Eagles are the Lane Johnson thing really is the only takeaway for me, right? That is the only thing if you're an Eagles fan you care about. I don't care about this loss. You're not going to go undefeated. Jalen Hurts is going to have a hiccup game where he throws 3 or 4 picks. That's going to happen every now and then. He's still a young player. You know, he's still accumulating information in the league and you're playing against a great defense. I don't really subscribe to that. The Jets defensive game plan was great. I mean, they bring in guys from the secondary. They flood the run gaps. They plug that up. I mean, Jeff Ulbrich, I thought, did an awesome job there. But yeah, I mean, it's Lane Johnson at this point, right? You know, that's my major takeaway if I'm the Eagles and the Jets. My major takeaway is I can't believe that you're getting Garrett Wilson the ball 8 times a game. That's pretty good. Whenever like Zach Wilson's your quarterback and you're getting Garrett Wilson the ball 8 times a game, like that's not bad.
Yeah. I mean, I think on the Eagles, it's similar to my takeaway with the Niners, you know, where the Niners, like your takeaway is you come out of it holding your breath on Christian McCaffrey and Deebo Samuel. And oh, by the way, like it looks like they dodged a bullet on Trent Williams, but that would have been the most catastrophic one of all.
100%.
Like losing Trent Williams. I'm not trying to diminish what Deebo and McCaffrey are as players, but like losing Trent like would have been really, really bad for them. And it's the same thing, you know, with the Eagles. Like you come out of that one, okay, like that didn't go our way. But those games are going to happen. Now let's make sure Lane Johnson's okay, you know, because so much of the personality of that team runs through the lines of scrimmage, runs through the 4 players that have been there for over 10 years and Jason Kelce, Lane Johnson, Brandon Graham, and Fletcher Cox. And it's like why they've been able to be so good through like several, I guess, reimaginations, not rebuilds, but retools, right? Because that the offensive line, defensive line have always been like steady and really good. And, you know, you take like a piece like Lane Johnson out and it definitely threatens the whole thing. And it's the one spot where it's really hard. Tackle is a spot where it's really hard to just make it work. You know, if you lose one of your starting tackles, there's almost certainly going to be a drop off to the next guy. And there are going to be less creative solutions that you're going to have on the table to fix what's going to be left when you lose a guy like that.
I think Lane Johnson would play with a broken leg like Jack Youngblood.
Where did he play? He played with what was it that he played with? There was something, right?
It was like a torn groin, like a completely torn groin, wasn't it? Like he just
it was something. Yeah, you're right. It was something like that that was very painful sounding, like groin torn off the bone or something like that.
Ew. All right. We mentioned Belichick. That wasn't where I was going to go, but I do want to touch on this. I have something. So your buddies, Toucher and Rich, 98.5 there in Boston, they had me on to atone for my Patriots AFC pick, which I did gladly. I think in this business.
Was it a full like falling on the sword then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, okay. here's the thing. I think we need to, I've said this before, you need to introduce a little humility into this, Albert. Yep. Like, if we're going to go out on a limb, we have to fall on the sword, because otherwise people are going to think we're just out there trying to
just
bait
taking
them.
Swings.
Yeah. And I've said it a couple times. Like, I went out there to watch training camp to confirm what I had heard. I was talking to coaches in the NFL, and they're telling me, the one coach I still hate to face is Bill Belichick. He's still got it. I'm talking to coaches in the college space, and they're saying, wait till you see what Bill O'Brien's got coming from Alabama. And I'm thinking, oh my God, and they're getting Ezekiel Elliott. Look at how good this is going to be. Not the case. Okay.
The problem is the players aren't just
the players suck.
Enough.
Yeah. So, I fell on that sword. But they brought up something that was so fascinating. And depending on what time you guys listen to the podcast, you should be able to read it on SI.com. If not, it's coming soon. They asked me this, and so then I wrote about it too. Would you trade for Bill Belichick? I would. In a heartbeat. Let's say he's available. Would you trade a first round pick for Bill Belichick? I would. 100%.
Would you give him control?
Yes. And here's why. Can I tell you my whole thing? All right. I'll be quick, because I know that no one cares about this but me. It's my fantasy world. If I'm picking 15 to 22, 23, 24, somewhere in that area, I'm a good but not great team. I am spending my first round pick next year to get him as coach emeritus / consultant / defensive coordinator. He gets to coordinate the defense, which is what he's excellent at. And then all of his other free time, I want him wandering around the building. I want him grilling people. I want him asking questions. And I want him telling me what he thinks as an owner of what is happening in my organization. I want him to identify Tom Brady type players, players who are going to work harder than everybody else. And I want to give him the platform to allow that stuff to surface. I want Bill Belichick to be my McKinsey and Company, but it cost me a first round pick instead of $220,000 an hour. What do you
think?
And he's coaching the team. And he's
going
to do the defense. And so, like, I have a young guy, like maybe like a Kevin O'Connell. He's co-coach. Kevin O'Connell does.
Co-coach, okay.
Yeah.
So are you talking about him essentially being Parcells in Miami then?
Yeah.
Okay.
What do you think about that?
Let me ask you this. If you are Josh Harris in Washington.
Yes.
Would you, and you decide, and like, look, like, I'm not firing anybody there yet. They're 3-3. They've played relatively well. Sam Howell looks good. Like, I'm not firing anybody there yet. But let's say that thing goes the wrong way. And you're looking to gain some credibility as an NFL owner. Because I think that that's the play if you're hiring Belichick, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so I think there are two real trends in hiring coaches right now, and that's the young offensive mind and it's the ex-player. Both have worked, right? Like, so we've seen it with McVay and Shanahan and McDaniel and all those guys with the offensive coaches. We've seen it with the ex-players with Dan Campbell and Mike Vrabel, now D'Amico. It looks like that one's really going to work out, right? Like, so we've seen both those tracks really work, right? So it'd have to be outside of that. So what sort of owner would be looking for something that would be outside of that, that maybe would want to do something a little bit more risk averse, that would want to gain some credibility among NFL owners? Hiring Belichick. That's how you, I mean, to give your organization some credibility, if you're a new owner, you hire Belichick. You know where Belichick's from, right? Annapolis.
Yes.
So it's right there for him. So do you bring him in that Parcells type of role and let him hire coaches and let him hire front office people? And, you know, that's sort of like Parcells did that. And people forget that sort of worked, like, in the immediate aftermath. Like, that worked. Stephen Ross was a new owner. And, like, that first year, Tony Sperano came in. Jeff Ireland came in.
Yeah.
They won 10. They're the only team.
Wasn't Chris Greer part of that somehow? Like, he's been there forever. Chris Greer wasn't.
Yeah, he was
part
like,
of
he,
that
was like he was like the college scouting director or something.
Okay. Yeah.
Because he knew Parcells, because Parcells worked with his dad, Bobby Greer.
That's right. Okay.
So, but, like, you know, this is another thing, one of those things. Like, it's like the Favre thing with the Jets. Like, people say, like, it didn't work at all. Well, it kind of did, and then he got hurt, right? Like, So this is the same thing. This is like, it worked with Parcells for a year, and then like I think Parcells got tired of the job and was like, and then it was sort of over after a couple of years, and then all hell broke loose when it was over because it was like a substitute teacher type of situation. You remember they flew to see Harbaugh when Sperano was still the coach. God rest Sperano's soul. But like there was like all that, like all hell broke loose after Parcells left. But while Big Bill was there, if you look at it, they were 1-15 the year before, right? Cam Cameron was a disaster. Like, I mean, go back and read this stuff from 2007, a complete disaster, as bad as it gets. Like, I think, if I remember right, one of the linebackers, was a Channing Crowder, like, might have challenged him to a fight in a team meeting or something like that. So it was, like, as bad as it gets. And the owner was new. Stephen Ross was new. And he needed credibility. So he hired Bill Parcells. Bill Parcells then basically took the infrastructure from Dallas and put it in place in Miami, and they won the division. Now, that was the Matt Castle year, but that was the only team other than New England to win the AFC East between 2003 and 2019. The only team. So it did work. And I think, like, unless Belichick is so consumed with getting the Shula record, which he might be because he's close enough, but unless he's really, like, that might be the play, is Washington hires him as, it's like, executive vice president of football operations, and then allows him to stalk the front office, to stalk the coaching staff, and the owner gets instant credibility. That was the play for Stephen Ross in Miami in 2008, and I could certainly see it being the play for Josh Harris at some point over the next couple of years in Washington if Belichick becomes available.
I pre-stocked the, no offense to Belichick, I pre-stocked the coaching staff, but just because I think Tom Curran, who we both love and respect. I mean, he had a great point, I thought, post game with the Patriots, and this coaching staff is very small and it's very overworked, and I think it's very overmatched outside of your main guys, right? Outside of Gerard Mayo, outside of Bill O'Brien. I mean, this is not comparable to your standard NFL coaching staff.
Patricia vindicated?
Maybe. Gosh. Wouldn't that be weird if that's the one thing that comes full circle this year? You know, all the way back around is like, that Matt Patricia was actually not a bad offensive coordinator. I don't know. I mean, hey.
I think there are a fair amount of misperceptions about him. Now, I don't think it was like the right move to hire, you know, Matt and Joe to run the Patriots offense in 2022. But like, I do think like 23 has given us a very full picture of what they were up against last year.
Yeah. This game wasn't necessarily super exciting for me to talk about. There was the Mac Jones kind of like rollout airmail interception. There was, you know, some bad tackling. I thought, you know, McDaniels, I guess, did a decent job of creating some space with this offense, but it's a plodding victory. For me at this point, my other big question here is, like, if you're the Patriots, do you just take this all the way at this point?
Well, you get Buffalo and Miami the next 2 weeks.
You get Buffalo. So, okay. So you're 1-6.
That put them at 1-7.
1-7. Caleb Williams is close. I don't know, Albert. That's my other question.
If you're 1-7 and then it's like, that's October 29th, do you start offloading?
Yes.
Because you don't tank, right? It's hard.
What are you offloading? I don't know. I mean, what's everybody taken from you? But
just start cutting guys.
I mean,
whoa, that's weird. They cut their starting offensive line.
And then full circle, where did Cliff Kingsbury start his career? Who's tutoring Caleb Williams now?
Oh, Albert, there you
in
go.
New England with Bill Belichick. Come
there
on.
There you go. There you
All
go.
All right, we figured it out. Boy, that was, if anybody wants to talk about this game, I don't know what to offer you.
The one thing I would offer, and I do think the Raiders deserve some credit here. The last 2 weeks, their wins over the Packers and Patriots.
Yes.
These are the games they lost last year. Yep. And I do think one thing Josh McDaniels was trying to do was bring in guys that would give him a smarter, more resourceful, more situationally aware team. And guys like Marcus Epps from Philly and Robert Spillane from Pittsburgh. And I do think to some degree you see that stuff showing up. Will it make them a playoff team? Probably not. But they're better in those situations than they were.
If they can scrap to like 9-8, do they make it to next year?
Yeah, I think so. I think Mark Davis is, I mean, look, like he's very involved. He still has those colorful meetings post-game with his head coach, the way he did with Gruden. But I think that I would think he gets another year, yeah.
Lions and Buccaneers, this was one that I had an eye on because at Tampa, I mean, that division is just so up for grabs. Dude. This was one of these games that I thought that the Buccaneers could come in and they could surprise people. You're wearing the creamsicle uniforms. And I don't know. I mean, yes, the Lions scored 20 points. You only scored 3. It's a failure. I do think that holding the Lions to 20 points is pretty good. And you basically just had a busted long Jameson Williams touchdown. I do think that I'm still in on the Bucs. Baker admitted he played a bad game. But I don't know. I mean, this was
the
wasn't...
Lions. I mean, the Lions only rushed for 40 yards.
Yeah.
Like, so, like, and this is a team that's been running the ball on everybody. Now Montgomery got hurt, and that's a factor. You know, and Goff winds up throwing for 353 yards, which, again, like, people are reluctant to give Jared Goff credit for anything, but he's a really good quarterback now, like, for those who are paying attention. Like, and this is a team that can win different ways, you know, and so the Lions, we said it last week. This isn't a Cinderella story anymore. Like, I don't know. Like I'm not going to tell you they can't, like, pull an upset of Philly or San Francisco in the divisional round. And
oh, suddenly... I think it's totally possible. Like, this team should be looking at a potentially at representing the NFC in the Super Bowl.
Right, right. So, like, I think you're right not to take away too much from the Bucs if we do look at the Lions in proper context and that, like, they aren't just, like, this cute story. They're a legitimate, like, NFC power now. And so, like, yes, Baker's going to have to be better in situations like this, but the Lions have made a lot of quarterbacks look bad.
Yeah. I am now really – the NFC South, I think I care more about at this moment than I ever have in my life because it's just – it's totally wild. And –
it's everything we thought it might be.
It's everything we thought it might be. At this point, let me just fire up our Google machine here. 3-2, the Buccaneers. 3-3, Falcons. 3-3, Saints. And then the 0-6 Panthers. Everybody in that division lost yesterday following a win. And then the Panthers have lost 6 in a row. I love it. I absolutely love this. I think... yeah, the Saints and the Buccaneers are the only teams with positive point differentials in the division. And, God, it is just, it's so much fun. It's so cool. Again, I'm not out on them yet, though. I think that this was one of those games where we're going to look back on this at the end of the season and say, actually, they played them pretty close. They played them pretty well. And this was one of those games where you just needed a next level player under center and you don't have it. You have a game manager plus, which is fine. It's just
and it does feel like Atlanta, Tampa and New Orleans, there's talent on those rosters, you know. I think like what we're seeing the separation at now, and this is like, I feel like this is like always oversimplifying it, but it's a quarterback, right? Like Ritter throws 3 picks yesterday against Washington. I think 2 of them were in the end zone, and that's really right now the difference between Atlanta and the Saints and the Bucs. Not that the Saints and the Bucs are outstanding at quarterback, but they've got guys who've led teams to the playoffs that are steady. I think coming out of the first 6 weeks, you probably look at Tampa and New Orleans as the teams. I think they're going to be the two teams standing at the end. And I'm a guy who picked Atlanta to win the division before the year. I worry right now about Ritter being in these high leverage situations. I maybe underrated that a little bit. Like Ritter being in these high leverage situations at the end of games where he's the one who's got to make a play to win.
It's all good, Albert. You know, some of us pick the Falcons and Desmond Ritter to win the division. Some of us pick the Patriots to win the AFCs. Like these are things that happen. You know, you have to let it go. My only,
does that mean I need to go to an Atlanta sports radio now?
My only game thoughts here were I thought just a hell of a job from Aaron Glenn. I thought the Buccaneers were going to go down and score. They kind of had the RPO game working at the end of the half and then just totally shut it down. They batted down a pass at the line and then switched the field. And then right out of the half, they caught the Buccaneers kind of being aggressive. They thought they could kind of stuff the interior and blitz Goff, and then all of a sudden kind of some big gains and they start moving the ball. So
yeah, just, and the resurrection of the Lions defense has been unbelievable. Like, Aaron Glenn deserves a lot of credit. A lot of people wanted him fired a year ago at this time. Like, they were historically bad, you know, what, through 6, 7, 8 weeks mm-hmm. of last year. And he's turned it around, and that's a top-level defense now.
The Jaguars, Albert, and the Colts, the Jaguars are now winners of three straight, coming off of the 2-0. The London thing is, I never thought of how big of an advantage it was until Jameson Hensley, who covers the Ravens for ESPN and does a really great job, sort of a legend on that beat, did an oral history of the Ravens' first London game where they got their doors blown off of them. And to hear players admit on the record how tired they were, and they had arrived on Thursday for the London game and then coming back, you know, it was one of those things where I finally had total sympathy for a situation where you're flying overseas, you're totally adjusting yeah. your body clock, and it's a real advantage, I think, for Jacksonville. Now, to come off of that and to come home and to get a big win against the Colts like this, I thought that was huge.
Yeah, and I think the crazy thing is now they play on Thursday night. They got to go to New Orleans on Thursday night. So
I think they could. I think they could lose that game by two scores, and it's just one of those, like, it is what it is games, you know?
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, I think this is one of those things that can be galvanizing for a team. And there were a couple of plays that Trevor made in that game. Like, Trevor, you know, I look at, like, the throw he made to Ridley in London. Which one? Was it the first London game? I think it was to beat Buffalo, right? The one he made down the sideline to Ridley. It was like a 3rd and 4 or 3rd and 3. I think it was Buffalo, because they Buffalo was going to get the ball back. And they were down by like 4, and they went to the line, and basically Trevor saw something at the line and checked to this play where it was going to be Ridley 35 yards downfield and just put a dime on him, you know? And you can sort of like feel like the Trevor from Clemson coming out, and the talent around him, like, Etienne looked unbelievable against the Colts, and he looks like he's really starting to break out now. And
he's scoring. He's getting the ball into the end zone, which right. all Etienne fantasy people from last year are like, yes, this is what we thought was going to happen.
Yeah, so it's they should win. All due respect to the Texans, who've done a lot of nice things. The Jaguars should run away with the AFC South. The Jaguars should be a 10, 11, 12 win team at least. And the Jaguars should be a problem in the playoffs. Because I do think Trevor's got the ability to be that type of quarterback. Like, I think if there's someone who has the ability to level up to the Allen, Burrow, you know, obviously Mahomes, like, that tier this year, I think that's who it is. Like, I think it's Trevor. And I think you're seeing signs over the last 3 weeks through a really challenging stretch for the team that he's going to get there.
Yeah. I think once we see, and this was, listen, playing Shane Steichen and Gardner Minshew, you know, the latter part of that, Gardner Minshew doesn't seem intimidating on its head, but Shane is one of the best play callers in the NFL. I think logging a win over these guys, no matter what, is a solid, but I do think that in order for us to fully realize the potential of the Jaguars, we're going to need that defense to rise to the level of the young talent. And I think it's getting there. I thought that, you know, like, we often kind of judge these teams on some of these big plays. And, you know, I think that they were kind of maybe a guy was a foot to the left of having a tip ball pick six. Like, we're very close to some of these things being very regular occurrences in Jacksonville. Really only one total blown play that I remember, which is that big Jonathan Taylor gain before the half. But otherwise, you know, I think it was solid, right? And you did pick off Gardner Minshew before the half. So it's like, you know, I don't know. I think they're almost there. I think they're, like you said, very close to being a dominant football team, which is exciting.
Yep, no doubt.
Saints, Texans, and then we're going to get Albert into our lightning round. How did this happen? I think part of this is we should take time 5, 6, 7 weeks into the season to just stop and be like, how are the Texans this good? How did it happen so quickly? What do you know? What did you know about the Texans that I apparently did not know? You're plugged into CJ Stroud. You guys are best friends. You guys ate at the same dining hall. I get it. You know, but how is this happening?
I just think it's, I don't want to boil it down to just the coach, but I think like what D'Amico has done is he's brought an energy to that building, and you can see it in the way that they play. And they have gone, and to Nick Caserio's credit, like he has gone out and got pieces that fit what D'Amico is trying to build past just the quarterback. And, you know, to go out and to draft Will Anderson, who plays so fast and is exactly the type that he wants, to bring in veterans like Jimmy Ward, you know, to put D'Amico in a situation where he can start to weaponize young guys like Petrie. Like they have, I think, more talent than people realize, more talent than I realize. They've got a young player who's really feeling it now. And, you know, I just think like after the last, it's almost like the last 2 years, going through they went through with the Deshaun thing lingering for as long as it did, and then the Jack Easterby thing, and then, you know, having two older coaches, you know, and Lovie Smith and God, why can't I even remember?
David Culley,
like to have two older coaches, and then to turn now to D'Amico Ryans, who is young and who comes from the San Francisco system and who played in the league. Like I think you can actually see the energy on the field with the way that they're playing. And I was so impressed. I mean, obviously everybody's impressed with how CJ's played, right? But I was so impressed that they were able to get that done early in the year. And Bobby Slowick, probably their offensive coordinator, probably deserves some credit for this too. They were able to do it with four starting offensive linemen down. Mm-hmm. And they're starting to get healthier now, but to be able to get CJ Stroud rolling the way that they were without their starting offensive line out there. And with, I think, you know, some receivers that are promising, guys like Nico Collins, but still might need some time. It's just so impressive. I mean, D'Amico to me right now would be right there with Saleh and maybe a couple of other guys for my coach of the year. Dan Campbell, I think, would be in that mix too. But D'Amico's done a phenomenal job of getting everybody bought in and getting everybody playing a certain brand of football. And again, I know that sounds like I'm talking in generalities, but you can see the speed and the energy with which they're playing. It's really, really clear when you watch their games.
To me, the mark of a team that is entirely bought in is the moment when Stroud throws a pick, the Saints pick it off, and then the Texans' offensive players are punching the ball out of the defensive guy's hands. Like, that is all hands on deck, well-coached football, and then you go down and you score on that drive. It's a complete momentum changer.
It was Nico Collins, actually, who, like, you know, ran down. I think it was Zach Bond, right, who had the pick. He runs him down, and I talked to CJ after the game, and he said, you know, it was so interesting because he said, like, and you think a guy who has this streak of no interceptions, what was it, 191 throws, right? You'd think that guy's playing a really careful game, and he's like, no, like D'Amico's message to me throughout has been to be aggressive and to take shots. And he's like, he explained to me what happened on the play, which is really interesting. He said he was trying to move the linebacker with his eyes, and the linebacker didn't go. And he was just like, look, it's the NFL, man. The guy made a good play. He's like, but that's not going to stop me. I know conceptually I was doing the right thing and the guy made a play on me, but that's not going to stop me from taking chances. And then sure enough, what was it, two plays later, he hits the big one to Noah Brown and they're scoring a couple plays after that. So I don't know, man. I think, you know, over the next couple of months, we're going to dig into something that came alive in CJ Stroud in that national semifinal against Georgia. Because he plays the fearlessness now that I think is really noticeable. And again, it sort of fits what D'Amico is building there in Houston, I think, too.
You know,
it's amazing
to
have that. It's amazing you have that fearlessness and that aggression, and you're still not throwing any interceptions as a rookie. You know, like, I just think that's really, really interesting.
You know what your problem is, though, Albert? You mentioned he was trying to move him with his eyes. He should have tried to move him. You move someone with your hands. Only psychics can move people with their eyes. You know, that's
yeah. Pick them up and move them. You're saying,
wah, wah. Not funny. All right, we are going to the lightning round. Baltimore and Tennessee. Thank God we have no more of these early morning games. We don't live in Hawaii or Los Angeles. This isn't how life is supposed to be. I was super hopeful that Malik Willis would have taken command of this thing and marched them down and brought them back into this game. I thought he was going to. Didn't happen. Baltimore gets a big win. And to your point, Albert, I think this is a team with a lot of attractive trade pieces, and I just wonder what the Titans are going to do here.
Yeah, 2-4. Their quarterback's hurt. They have a bunch of guys that are either at 30 or close to 30. I know they just redid Kevin Byard's contract. I would think Kevin Byard would be attractive to somebody, right? DeAndre Hopkins, you just signed him. Would he be attractive to somebody? Derrick Henry, do you field phone calls on him? I mean, obviously, they're not going to trade like a Jeffrey Simmons or a Skoronski or any of those guys. But, you know, I do think that there are some older players in the roster where – you know, Christian Fulton, who's kind of fallen out of favor there, if Buffalo were to call on him, would you listen? Guy who's got starting experience as a corner. I just think, like, the Titans have to be sort of open to everything now. And it's going to really – it's going to be hard for Vrabel because I know how competitive he is, and he's not going to want to be playing out the string with, you know, with essentially replacement players. But I think it's sort of the crossroads that they're at with the core that they went to a conference championship game with a few years ago. It feels like that group is like sort of aged out, and they're taking the bullet from a cap perspective with all the dead money this year. And so this sort of makes sense as the time to offload some weapons for some draft capital, especially if you're looking at potentially drafting a quarterback in April.
For sure. Vikings and Bears, Justin Fields dislocates his finger. Albert, I think that is the takeaway here. I mean, nice defensive win for the Vikings. You know, I thought that was probably over the last few weeks, they've trying to establish the run. I thought they've been playing better defense. I think they're getting better. So, you know, I think that deserves to be mentioned here, but Fields' finger, I mean, I feel like this is, you know, that's kind of the big takeaway here.
Yeah. I don't have a ton to add. I mean, I just think it's, you know, the Bears have to get answers on Justin Fields, and something like this gets in the way. And he was really like playing pretty well. He built some momentum against Denver. I know that game didn't end the way that he would have wanted it to, but built some momentum and playing pretty well against Denver and Washington. And it felt like they were figuring out the right way to use him. He didn't play well early in that game. And that's the other, you know, sidebar to this whole thing. But certainly, like, with, you know, injury to his throwing thumb, that's not going to help them get a final answer on whether or not he's their guy of the future.
I wanted a Tyson Bagent revolution, though. Shepherd College, man. I mean, I was so excited for that. That's like an NCAA.
Lots of arm wrestling talk.
I know. If you look at the Twitter update for Justin Fields right now, all you get is somebody in a Justin Fields jersey, like, sucker punch somebody at the game yesterday, and that seems to be making the rounds. Don't do that, guys. You know, just, you know, wait in line for the bathroom like everybody else.
I have a theory about that. I think it's because, like, you have there's the secondary market is so active now that you have more people in the stadium that go to one game a year, so they get
they just want to get all they can out of it.
So they just get so blacked out in the parking lot, and they don't have to worry about their season tickets getting taken away, because that's like what prevents a lot of fights, probably, right? Like, is like if you're a season ticket holder, A, you're probably not getting just lit up in the parking lot every week, right? Like, and B, you're concerned that you might have your tickets taken away. If this is a one-off thing for you, then you're less worried about that, you know? So that's just my theory on why we're seeing more fights in the stadiums now.
I blacked out at one football game in my life, a college football game, and I mean, it was so unenjoyable.
A little time travel?
I drank, like, you know, and I don't drink anymore, but I drank a lot of old granddad in the parking lot. And then I remember the kickoff. I remember, like, the first three plays. And then I woke up midway through the fourth quarter, and I was like, this is terrible. Why do people do this? But, you know, you know, I don't know. I don't like throwing on a Justin Fields jersey and looking to UFC someone in the line for the bathroom. That's not something, you know.
I have a friend who will remain nameless, who, and we're
producer not, Shelby.
We're not young anymore. Who may or may not have puked fireball through his nose at the national championship game 3 years ago.
Oh.
And that was the game, by the way. That was the COVID national championship game. So there were only like 14,000 people in the stadium.
He was like swooped away and then landed in some. Well, here. So
better days for Justin Fields and Mac Jones, too. Better days for those two.
My only follow up there, though, is this something that he does on the reg, or was it one of those things where it's excusable because he tried to light it up? You know,
he doesn't do it. Well, so he's my friend who was. He's my buddy who, do you have a friend from college? I think everybody does. Who you'd go out, everybody go out drinking on a Tuesday, and it would, you know, you'd be out till like 4 a.m. and then like you wake up at like 11:30 a.m. and he's walking back from class. He's been to like 3 classes already and looks like he went to bed at like 10 p.m. the night before.
Yeah.
Like that's that guy.
Yeah.
And like it's even though he was like slumped over like a speaker. Like in the Beirut room the night before, like he is somehow has attended 3 classes by the time I've woken up, and I feel like I got punched in the face 15 times, and he's like going to work out, you know, like he's that guy. So
some people, you know, some people can handle the liquor a little bit better than others.
That's he it. Actually was the one who the Notre Dame weekend, I was afraid that he wasn't going to be sober enough to drive to the Chicago airport the next day and was totally fine. So even now, like he is, he's a warrior. He's a warrior.
Big props to Albert's buddy. Some heroes just, they don't wear capes. Falcons, Commanders, so disappointing for me. Like this was the game. If you're the Falcons, I wrote about this on Friday, like they have to realize, and I'm sure it's not like they don't realize this, but there were some soft pockets in their schedule. And as much of a slog as this division is going to be, you got to pick up these games when you can. Yeah. And to lose this one was heartbreaker for them.
Yep. Yeah. And they, I mean, it's so interesting what they've done at quarterback and whether or not they're going to pay for that now, because I do think conceptually it's the right thing to do. Like you don't want to, I don't know that I want to sell out for a Derek Carr or a Jimmy Garoppolo if I were them either, but it does feel like treading water, waiting for something they want to go all in on to come along. Like how much time do you get to do that? You know, because I do think that they've done a nice job building up other parts of the roster, and it's a well-coached team. But, you know, in today's NFL, you know, you get into the fourth quarter and you can't pull those situations out. You know what I mean? Like, because – and I don't want to put it all on Desmond Ridder because it's not all on Desmond Ridder, but are they asking too much of him right now? I don't know.
Yep. You know, Atlanta's defense, I thought they played well – especially at the end of that game, you know, they're, you know, Grady Jarrett getting back there and trying to get the ball back. And Ryan Nielsen, I think, has actually done a really nice job. I think he's probably the guy.
And quietly has the best mustache on the Falcons coaching staff. Oh, sorry, Arthur.
It is. Some guys can do it and some guys can't. And it always makes me wonder, you know, if you're getting work done in that. Are you getting that, like, steam pressed? Are you getting that? You know, is there some sort of additive there?
There has to be some product, right? I would think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're juicing a little bit. Cincinnati and Seattle. I mean, on paper, probably one of the bigger games of the week. But also, the Bengals are just like, no, we're good now. We're back. Nothing to worry about here. We're beating good teams again. I still don't know how Burrow is existing on the field and playing every down and stuff. But that's what it is, and that's where we're at.
I think they did a really good job to get to the bye at 3-3. Like, and I think like to be able to win 2 in a row now, and Joe put together, I think, 6 quarters of really good football. They weren't as good in the second half, right? But 6 quarters of really good football, 4 against Arizona, 2 against Seattle, and now he's got a 2-week layoff until his next game. It feels like that's a team where it could really come together with him, because the defensive line won that game. Like, if you watch the end of that game, like, it was Trey Hendrickson, Sam Hubbard, DJ Reader, BJ Hill with a big play at the end of the game. Like, the D-line won that game for them. And the secondary bailed them out in big spots in the second half. Mike Hilton had a pick. Cam Taylor-Britt had a pick. I don't know, man. Like, it feels to me like if – Joe can play the way we know he can play, and I think the 2 week layoff will help him get there. If he can kind of replicate what he was for six quarters over against Arizona and then the first half against Seattle, I think the Bengals jump right back in there as an AFC favorite.
Yeah. And they're starting to do the things as an offense where you can tell they're feared again. Like, they got a Seattle team. I mean, Pete Carroll's very fundamentally sound, you know, at the end of the first quarter to jump off sides, you know, on a fourth down. And, you know, they're doing those kind of things. And, you know, obviously they score on that drive too, but they're doing the things that a very vaunted sort of feared offense can start to do again. And I think those are the things when you see the defense being manipulated again, when you see the defense playing a little bit scared, that's how you can tell, I think, that there is that inherent respect for Burrow again. And, you know, all of a sudden, my Bengals Super Bowl pick doesn't look so bad again, which is nice.
That's right. That's right.
Miami.
I got them too. I think I had them winning it, but anyway.
Miami and Carolina. And all I got to say is I do our best bets with SI and some of our gambling crew, some of our football writers, and we have to pick against the spread. I'm a wild card in our staff picks anyway, Albert, but I am 1-5 now picking against the spread. And I thought the Panthers could, with 13.5 points, could have made this remotely interesting, but apparently not. It was 42-21. The Dolphins, I think, have gained more yards than like three other teams combined at this point.
Yeah.
It's wild.
I like the I do like the fact that they came from behind, like, because I think that that's the one thing maybe we hadn't seen from them quite as much. And look, the Panthers aren't very good, but for them to be down 14-0 and put their foot on the accelerator the way that they did. And Mike McDaniel mentioned it to the team in the locker room after the game on the video there that they put up, where there was no, like, I thought it was interesting the way he put it to his players. It was like, there was no come to Jesus meeting, which, like, a lot of times in these situations, you hear those stories about how, like, someone said something in the locker room, or someone said something in the sideline, or there was some side of some sort of adjustment. And I sort of liked it how Mike was like, no. Nobody said anything. He's like, and I liked it that you guys didn't have to say anything. We knew what to do, and we did it. And, you know, I think that's a sign of a team that's really confident. You know what I mean? That doesn't need that. Like, that doesn't need someone to step on their throat to make it happen. And so, the Dolphins are consistent, and, like, to be able to come back from that deficit, I think, showed us something we hadn't maybe seen to this point. And, it's... they're one of the five or six best teams in the AFC, no question.
I'm not going to stand for any Bryce Young slander at this point. I thought
too early.
The scripted first drive was flawless, and he's doing. Listen, he's doing all the things that you said, not you, the royal you. People are saying that he wasn't able to do. Like, he got absolutely plastered and hit like a 40-yarder to Thielen on that first touchdown drive. This team is just bad. It's a bad football team. And there's a reason that they were in the market for this kind of start over franchise quarterback thing. This is going to take 2 years, but Bryce Young is incredibly accurate, and he's making throws quietly that none of the other rookie quarterbacks are making. And I think you can watch that game and they're pickled with them. My only other thing that I thought was hilarious in this game was, even when they went up 14-0, they have the ESPN win probability metric, and they still gave the Dolphins a 55% chance of winning this game. Which, I thought was very
funny. I hate those metrics so good. They don't make any sense to me at all.
No.
But maybe that's because I'm stupid in my 40s.
No, we're aging gracefully. 26-9, the Rams-Cardinals score here. Not a bunch of overarching thoughts on this, Albert. The Rams are at 3-3, which I think, you know, if you would have taken the over, like I told you to, on their win total, 6.5 looks pretty...
The Cardinals keep playing hard. The Rams ran the ball really well, which I think is indicative of where they're going. Kylan Williams has done a really good job for them in the backfield. And I think it's sort of like the way I thought that game, the way you would think that game would go, where the Cardinals would hang around, and then eventually the Rams would wind up wearing them out and running away with it. And so I don't think we learned a whole lot of new things, but I mean, hey, Jonathan Gannon's got that group competitive on a week-to-week basis, and they're taking games into the second half every week and against good teams, so they deserve credit for that.
Yeah, Kyron Williams, 158 rushing yards. and Cooper Kupp's back. I'll say this, and you know, I think for everyone that's wondering where the next evolution in this offense goes, I think it's such a good thing that Puka Nacua only has 4 catches.
Yeah.
He blocked his ass off in this game, and they're setting up so much more for the end of this season. That's why I think this team could go on a tear. I think they could win 5 or 6 in a row at some point, even though it's a tough schedule. Last one, Giants Bills, angry Brian Daboll. Always one of my favorite things. Greg Rosenthal, my old boss, tweeted that, Brian Daboll is always good at making sure people on this watching the game know that something is not his fault. You know, there's the play before the half where he gets feisty and, you know, they check to a run. And yep. But this is what happened. You know, I mean, no offense to Tyrod Taylor, but this is what happens when you're down your quarterback, you know.
Yep.
And I thought they played really hard in a difficult environment. The Giants are doing the best they can. This is also a bad football team. It's not a bad coach football team.
No.
There's a lot of guys trying hard. I think
them and Minnesota are the same. This was the year they were taking the dead cap. This is the year that they were really going to reset. This was the year that they were going to kind of take their medicine after establishing their programs in year one. It's, I think, for both teams, the old Buffalo blueprint where, you know, Sean McDermott and Brandon Bede made the playoffs in year one, went 6-10 in year two, reset the cap, built up their draft capital, got a lot younger in year three, and away they went, you know. And so I think, you know, if you want to, you can look at those two teams that played in the wild card round last year in the Vikings and Giants, and you'll find a pretty similar blueprint. What is interesting to me is Buffalo. I don't know what it is, but like you keep seeing the flashes where it's just, are you worried about them?
No more than, I mean, I picked them to go 9-8 and finish second to the Patriots. So, you know,
well, if you had them finishing behind the Patriots, then I guess they're overachieving.
Yeah, I think they're doing great. I think we all thought this team was, I think they're due for a little regression, but they
have such a high ceiling. Like, I just think, like, I don't know, like, it's, but you do see, like, when they lose Tre'Davious White and Kair Elam's in there, you know, and Elam does not look great. It's like, oh, well, there's, you know, a missed first round pick. So is that going to cost them over the course of the year? It'll be interesting to see how that team evolves, because this did feel like one of those games where it was like, all right, Josh, put your cape on and get us through this, you know.
James Cook with 5.1 yards per carry. Are we seeing,
he looks good too.
Are we seeing the and right? I mean, my only thought here is that it didn't look great with Isaiah Pacheco at first, and it looked sloppy. But now they can win games with a run game, and that was everyone's complaint about this team for the Chiefs for years. Are we seeing the Bills kind of forcing themselves to do it the hard way and to build themselves for December and January again? And I don't know. I mean, running on the Giants, okay, but they do have some good interior players. I thought their backers are playing hard. You know, is this the first sign of, you know, maybe some progress there with the run game? I don't know.
Yeah, and James Cook, I think, is interesting too because he's a little smaller. So you wonder if they're going to have to manage the damage on him a little bit. Like, he does look like Dalvin the way he runs, but he's just not, like, he's not as big as Dalvin, you know? So you do wonder, is that going to catch up with them over time? I know they're cognizant of it, you know, and having to manage the amount of work they're giving him just because of how big he is.
All right, Albert, thanks as always. Dude, we crushed this one. No errors in this podcast. This is the podcast equivalent of a no-hitter. I'm in such a good mood. Maybe we'll start a Patreon and you get to go with Albert on his drive home from Foxborough. And you get to stop at Dunkin' Donuts with him. He'll do it live on video. Leave us a rating and review and tell us what you think. Absolutely. Also, be sure to tune in for Matt and Gilberto in the Thursday spot. Thank you guys again, as always. We love having you here, and we'll see you next Monday.
Now at Menards, save big on everything for your landscaping project. Whether you're shopping for edgers, pavers, or wall blocks, Menards has the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block ready to take home today. Plus, get fast free estimates when you use our landscape design program available in-store and on Menards.com. Save big on landscape blocks when you shop at Menards. Also, check out the great deals from our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.